What is the hole behind Midnight? Is it A,
a hyperconduit from the world of sanity to the world of bizarrery?
B,
a wonderful land of magic and enchantment?
4,
the state of half-awakeness coming from a dead sleep when you hear the cat vomit in the middle of the night?
X,
the place where all the lost socks and misplaced keys go to die?
Theta,
a whacked-out mental mind of epic proportions?
If you answered pound 7, all of the above, and more, you're correct. The Hole Behind Midnight is also a novel by Clinton J. Boomer, published by Broken Eye Books and available for the Kindle or Nook. Also coming soon as a dramatized audio novel, podcast for mature audiences only. Listen at www.theholebehindmidnight.libsyn.com.
And welcome, everyone, to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm still Grace.
I am the Klingon. Oh, I'm David.
It's true.
He's both.
And today, our special guest is a friend of mine. Her name is Chloe.
Hey there.
You might recognize her from being on Tales of the DMZ. She's in another episode that I'm currently producing. It's all recorded. I just need to get it all strung together, which will probably take about 5 years at the rate I'm going.
You literally just need to get it together.
Yeah, with actual string, too. It's like, you would think it's electronic, but no, it's all on string.
He's sitting in a lab splicing up footage and film stuff.
It's like the old tape where you actually had to do that.
Yeah.
Just go at it with a pair of scissors.
Yep.
I got my actual paste ready to go. All right, so today we are talking about Star Trek IV, the what now? The voyage home. I was like, the search for home? No, that's not it. Okay. But before that, I have a couple of quick announcements. The Mission Log Podcast is up for the Podcast Awards 2013 in the entertainment category. So whenever voting is open, you should go do that because they totally deserve it. Also, we have a
voting.
Just
real quick, the voting is open from November 1st to November 15th, and you could vote once every day. So,
oh man, it's officially open.
Yep.
Power to the people. Uh-oh. Make your vote heard.
Yeah, because, Mission Log is the best. We also have a Facebook page where I post various discussion questions and other bits of trivia. So if you guys are interested, you should totally join that. It's, I post some funny stuff. I had a bit of a thought the other day, which was that how come when the Bird of Prey lands in Golden Gate Park, people aren't running into it?
And I can answer that for you, actually.
Can you?
Because Golden Gate Park is freaking huge.
Yeah, but it has a lot of people in it.
Yeah, but not in every part. There are some parts that get more traffic than others.
Well, this one was next to the park benches. It couldn't have had, and like the road. It couldn't
have
had.
There are park benches everywhere. God.
We're talking 35,000 people a day.
Yeah, but it's not like it's the museum or the playground or something. It's not a hot spot in the park.
I guess.
Well, there was those two joggers that got, blasted by the takeoff.
They're special.
Yeah, they told the story and they knew it was a dangerous place.
Yeah.
And, the trash people who were remarkably, cooperative. They were like, no, we didn't see anything. We're not going to put this in the tabloids. Don't worry about
it. They could have thought they were sniffing diesel fumes or something from the truck.
All right, so let's get started. I'm actually going to hold the email this week just because we're a bit short on time, but I promise I will get to it, Christopher. Don't worry about it.
We haven't forgotten you. Never forget.
So let's talk about the visual effects and the sound first, because that's how we do things here on our Star Trek movie review show. I really love what they did with the inside of the Bird of Prey.
It does look a lot better. It looks more like a ship and less like a... like a punch bowl full of chairs.
Yeah,
it looks like a closet.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed that when I was watching it, because we just watched the 3, and this is supposed to be the same Bird of Prey, the Kruge's Bird of Prey that they captured, and then they're parked. They opened up this movie. They're parked on Vulcan, and I thought, wait a minute, did the Vulcans have like a spare Klingon bridge module just laying around? That let's switch it out.
They had to feng shui it up before they could comfortably use it, I guess.
Look, they called the same bridge redecorators that Sulu calls in Star Trek VI when we get an actual bridge for the Excelsior and not like this football field of a bridge from Star Trek III. It doesn't have the pit of command anymore. It's like, you know, Kirk isn't in danger of falling on Chekhov if the ship, you know, rocks too much.
And it's Star Trek, so the ship always rocks.
Yeah, that's true. Although a surprisingly minimal amount of ship rocking in this episode.
Right?
Like, when the ship was rocking, it was generally because it was actually unpowered and just falling towards the planet.
When the ships are rocking.
Well, yeah, there's that. But I was willing to give them a little bit.
The whale's coming knocking.
And I don't know, I liked the interior. I thought it had a very utilitarian look to it. It wasn't, you know,
does, it looks more usable.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, you know, the Enterprise 2 or anything. It was it was different, but functional.
And I liked the color scheme.
I was just going to say, they turned all the lights on because we don't have the whole red tint that Klingons, you know, kind of dig for the mood lighting.
Look, there's a slider. It goes all the way up, but Klingons only ever put it at about 70%.
It's like the entire thing. With the
red handkerchief.
And said, "Oh, this is ridiculous.
This is so dark.
I can't see the control panels, Captain.
No wonder they're angry all the time."
But I mean, I liked the interior colors better than in Star Trek III, where everything was gray, or when you were in the Klingon ship, everything you had that red tint. I just thought that it popped better this time, and the control panels I thought were better laid out, even if they did change it to look a little bit more Enterprise-y. You know, it was better than what they had before. Also,
you mentioned like the panels and stuff. I noticed in the credits that part of the computer display, computer animation and tactical display, whatever they called it. Mm-hmm. Mike Okuda worked on it.
Yep.
I had forgotten that he worked on this one.
This was his first Star Trek project, actually. This is the beginning of his relationship with the franchise, so, and I think we all came out the better for that one.
It started a long whirlwind romance.
And another thing about the visuals that were very good were the whales.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
They look like whales.
Apparently good enough that several, like, fishing agencies thought they were real and gave the movie a hard time for being too close to whales. And being like, you shouldn't bother whales like that. It's like, not a real whale, man.
Just drop Leonard Nimoy in a whale tank and call it a movie.
Well, I mean, maybe
you
could.
Well, you probably could, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not gonna lie, I'd watch it constantly.
I think we all would. But yeah, the whale prosthetics...
I'd just be like a fireplace. I'd have it going at all times.
Were very, very good, especially like the tail that they have when they're all in the water.
Yeah,
Like, you know, it looks very real. It doesn't look like a bad CGI whale.
Nope.
There's only really one whale effect that, you know, not whale effect, that looking back on it is kind of cheesy looking, which is that at the very beginning when they're going into the museum, you see what is supposed to be a whale breaching the surface of the tank, but it really just looks kind of like a black outline in the shape of a whale. And it's like, okay, someone's doing some shadow puppetry in here.
It's a whale of a problem.
Oh, this is what you're in for the rest of the hour, folks. Bunch of whale puns.
Pretty much, yeah.
Deal with it. Star Trek 4, space whales.
Leonard Nimoy had said that pretty much 95% of all the whales seen in the movie are the man-made ones, and there's only one or two shots of real whales.
Yeah, when they're
Right. The video that I watched, the DVD, it was from 99. It had a bonus feature, and it had a little section about the whales, and it was really cool because it showed when you see the full-body whales swimming around, those were remote-controlled, you know, actual, you know, you see the two guys with the switches, and they were 5 feet long. They showed it without the skin. It was just like a lot of gears and servos, and then they put this rubbery flesh, you know, on it that's painted really good. Then they were testing it in a tank, and, you know, the guys are having a blast controlling this whale, making it swim, and they have a little seal, a spotted seal in the tank, and it's like swimming around, freaking out, going like, "What am I?" The seal was basically looking like it was real, you know, and it was like going up to sniff.
Why was there a spotted seal in the tank?
They filmed it at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, so I think they probably just dropped them in one of those tanks.
Which is one of my favorite aquariums. Yes, I have favorites.
That's fair. Although, my question is that if the whales were robotic, why were the museum people complaining about having to feed them, like, shrimp? Like, that doesn't make sense. They were robots. All right, I'm sorry. That was a joke.
They were very picky robots. They had it in their contracts.
So they did very well with the whale effects. Maybe not as nice with the space log.
Space log just looks like an unlit cigarette flying through the air.
Or like an aerosol can or a cigar.
Or a marital aid.
Yeah, there's that too. I'm not really sure what I wanted it to look like, but it doesn't exactly inspire awe or fear.
Maybe it was supposed to kind of look like the obelisk from 2001: A Space Odyssey, but it really just looks like someone got lazy.
Yeah, it's just kind of this brown cylinder floating through space.
It's like something they never quite got back to after like they were like, we'll just like put this as a placeholder.
Yeah,
we'll get back to that. Remember that, guys? And they're watching the movie. Like, oh shit.
And then what's that blue ball thing that was like floating?
I thought it was like a tiny speaker or something, the little blue ball.
They have a very inefficient like stereo system set up. Like instead of like, you know, the Enterprise can just send communications, but these guys have to lower an actual speaker, which works in space. Don't ask me how, and go blah, whale song.
Space speaker. No, it was more like
Oh, that's true. I mean, I have no idea how the whales are supposed to have received that, which is part of the plot, which we'll get to later. But
how can the whales hear it from underwater? Everybody picked up in space.
That's a question that no one in this movie is terribly interested in answering. and of course, like the on-site locations are pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Like the on location shots, like they're actually in San Francisco. That's nice.
It is.
They're not trying to tell us that Portland is San Francisco or anything like that, which is
never happens in movies. What? Vancouver?
No, we promise it's New York, guys. Seriously.
It's New York, it's Maine, and it's New Jersey, all in one convenient location. Canada!
It's also kind of cool that they actually got to film on board an aircraft carrier. The shout out to the ye olde USS Ranger.
What?
Which, unfortunately, they couldn't film on the actual Enterprise, both because it was out at sea and that was hella classified at that point. Yeah. It was, you know, a nuclear submarine in the 80s. And they aren't going to let a Russian spy on one of those.
Not in leather pants.
Yeah, especially.
Especially not one with Chekhov's level of devotion to keeping up the Russian thing,
as
we've established.
We've established in between episodes that Chekhov doesn't actually have a Russian accent. He just loves Russia so much that he affects one. Mm. And we saw that come out just a little bit, as David pointed out, in the motion picture, when he couldn't quite keep the accent up because he was being time-warped.
He cracks under pressure.
Torpedoes.
Yeah, they originally put Chekhov in season 2 just because Russia was saying that they were trying to get a multicultural thing and that they just wanted a Russian in there. So, you know, having an American who's just truly devoted to Russia might be just more a better thing than having a bad Russian.
He's a Russia fanboy.
Russia. See, Russia, you're great. We have an American who loves you.
Yeah, well,
not a bad Russian.
It's the only way you can explain his accent.
Yeah.
You know.
We're sorry, Mr. Kanyang, we love you.
Look, that wasn't his fault, right? I mean, they told him to do that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that if he really put his mind to it, he could manage a better Russian accent.
Yeah.
But, you know,
can't all be Anton Yelkin.
It wouldn't sound so amazingly Russian, is sort of the case. Now, one thing, a visual that I was very confused about, and I'll get your guys' input on this, what's up with, like, the acid trip that they have after they go back?
Just with the rolling heads?
Well, like,
what are they trying to say here?
Well, okay, the rolling heads I kind of get, because that's dialogue from later in the movie, right? So it's like, oh, they're messing with time, here's some lines that you don't know what they mean, and then later you'll hear them and be like, oh, it was a time thing. But what's with the guy falling into the water? Like, what is that?
It's almost like the Twilight Zone intro, where it's like you see an eyeball float by, you see the body float, you know, all this weird stuff. And then there was like a shape at the end. They're like, it made a whale sound, but it kind of looked like an abstract bird of prey. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what? But then how come we also didn't see it again with an extra Jillian Taylor head when they go back to the future? I don't know.
I was a little surprised that we didn't see something similar when they came back. I guess by then they were out of time.
My initial thought is that, like, they went back in time and, like, the change in atmosphere of some sort was unsettling, but then they go to different planets all the time.
That's true.
Atmospheres, so that doesn't make sense.
They're back at Earth. It's not that different.
Well,
it's pollution and all.
They just all start hacking and coughing. But, I mean, no, because you have that scene, right, and it's got the rolling heads and then what I think is supposed to be a whale silhouette. And then, like, it's got this guy who is, I think, naked and is falling into water. And then it fades.
And who is clearly none of the crew because he's way too not old.
He's not like anybody, really.
He could be a red shirt without a red shirt.
Yeah, that's possible.
Ooh, but, in red shirt.
And then there's like, and then it cuts to cattails or willows or something. And it's like a shot that we never see again. And I'm like, what is even going on here? And then, of course, the movie continues. Which I struggle to understand that particular choice.
I think that was just Leonard Nimoy unleashing his inner Salvador Dali.
Yeah, he did turn into an artist eventually.
Yeah.
That's true.
He was always an artist.
It was just his.
He became a visual artist later in life. He saw those cattails and were like, those are in my movie.
Those are great.
get in the shot. And the writers were like, Nimoy, what does that have to do with anything? And he's like, shh.
I am Nimoy. Environmentalism, guys. Let's have some environment in here. Cattails.
This is an environment. This is the endangered cattail.
Yeah. For all we know, it could be a thing.
I also really liked the bird of prey sinking. I thought they did a pretty good job with that one, too. That nice little bird of prey bridge prop. Although this movie is also, I think, what might be the original scale goof, when they have the bird of prey decloak over the whaling ship, and it's like this massive thing. I'm like, oh god, that ship is huge.
Yeah. But at the same time, it doesn't look like it would be the size to fit a pair of whales in it, though.
Yeah, David, what were you saying?
The whole bird of prey thing. If there's like a good article over at X asterisk scientia, however you say that, but like the Defiant, the bird of prey has been fluctuating in size all throughout Trek, and this one you see it over the whaling ship, and then later they would show a bird of prey like right up against the like nose to nose with the Enterprise D, and it would be almost as big as the saucer section, and people are like, that don't make sense, but this was supposed to be like, you know, I guess from retcon and, you know, expanded in their like technical manuals, this was supposed to be a Burrell class scout ship, and the giant big one bird of prey are Cavort. But even then it's like they fluctuate, but the sinking of the bird of prey, and at one point we see like a model of the bird of prey going like skimming across the water. That was a big prop, and then you have the big bridge set that everybody's jumping off of. That was in a big tank, obviously a big water tank that was on the Paramount lot, and Nimoy in that featurette was saying that in old Hollywood, like every studio had a big tank for like submarine movies and pirate movies and everything, but they were all shut down. And at Paramount, they were in the parking lot and noticed like big grooves or seams in the ground. And they looked at the plans, and Paramount had a water tank, but they filled it with dirt and put a parking lot on top of it. So they had to get like the backhoes and excavate, and they dug out the water pit. So then now they were using the water pit on Paramount's lot that was like 15 feet deep. And so that's where they put the bird of prey head or bridge or nose cone, whatever you want to call it, and where they're all on top of it. That was trippy.
I think there's a reason these movies have aged more than some of them, the ones that came after, or have aged better, excuse me, more than some of the ones that came after. Because, like, they actually, it feels like they use a lot more real shots.
Yeah, a lot more practical effects.
Like, you know, a model in a pool of water is going to look just as real, like, 20 years down the line. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you throw some CGI, it's not going to, I don't know. I just, how real this a lot of the stuff looked in this movie was very appealing to me. Like,
off topic. Quick note about the sinking of the bird of prey, though. Does anyone else feel like really sorry for Chekhov having to jump in the water without any pants on? He's still wearing his hospital gown.
Did he not have time to get changed?
Nope, he's still wearing the hospital gown.
Although, let me tell you, that hospital gown is way more practical than any of the hospital gowns I've ever worn. It's like, you know, he leaps off, he's like, he gets up off the bed, and I'm like, are we going to see Chekhov's butt? And he's like, no, it covers everything. It's like, huh, that must be a movie issue, hospital gown. Maybe they made him with more fabric in the 80s. But, all right, so are we done talking about visual effects? Do you guys have more stuff you want to throw in there?
Just that the size of the interior of the bird of prey, where they are able to, like, fit tanks for whales, bothered me a little.
Yeah.
They've got, like, this huge-ass hall in this little sort of utilitarian-looking bird of prey. That seems a little odd.
It's another scale issue, because they show the back of the bird of prey and the ramp coming down, so we know how big that is, and it doesn't look big enough for whales.
Maybe it's bigger on the inside.
Yeah.
And when when Scotty was dealing with, you know, the plexiglass guy, he was asking him how thick would it have to be to hold this much water, and he said like it was 60 by 10.
Yeah.
And so that, I was thinking 60 feet long. I don't know if that. And yeah, I don't. Why would the Klingons have just a huge? Unless it was the mess hall, like the cafeteria. I don't know why they would have a big space like that.
It's a big open space. That's where they kept all the gach. It's empty now because Scotty got rid of all of the food. Yeah, which is weird that they had to wait for Scotty to do that. Apparently, everyone else was just fine with the Klingon food, but Scotty was like, "No, I can't deal with this."
From the person who eats haggis, really.
Yeah. Of all of them, you figure he would be the most, you know, the most susceptible to Klingon food.
The most like, yeah, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's...
Well, he would wash it down with his Aldebaran whiskey.
It is green. It's been suggested in the chat room that maybe that was the cargo bay, and I think that was the intention, because it was filled with, like, random boxes and stuff. But I just have a hard time believing that a bird of prey would have such a big cargo bay. Because it's like a military scout ship. It's not a hauler, you know? Like, its job is to fly around and shoot things with laser beams.
As far as we know.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that Krug was actually a freighter captain the whole time, and that's why he was so angry. The Klingons just build their freighters
he
really
heavily armed.
He had a great
big convoy rocking through the night.
Oh, dear.
And then he kind of lost it and decided he was going to, you know, destroy Genesis.
He was going to steal Genesis.
Yeah, that's the one.
All right, all right. So, let's talk about costumes.
Breaker, wahoo.
Let's talk about costumes real quick. Mm-hmm. So, like, you got like half the crew in uniform and half of them not in uniform. And like Uhura, all right, Uhura makes sense. I understand why she's still wearing her uniform.
It also kind of works for, you know, looking sharp like a lady in the 80s.
It's true. And
shoulder pads.
Like, and Kirk is still wearing his, I guess. I was a little surprised that Scotty was still wearing his uniform. It just, like, especially since he seems to take every other opportunity later to wear something different. Like, because he's got that, like, that white and black uniform that he wears most. But today he was but in this movie he was in the reds. Mm-hmm. But I'd really like Chekhov and Sulu's outfits. I think they
were good, yeah.
Especially Sulu's, because, like, Chekhov, as we pointed out, is having to run in leather pants. Aww. Is maybe not the greatest outfit. But, like, Sulu, I thought, had a really cool jacket, which he only ever wears one sleeve of, because he's just that cool.
He's got swagger. He really does. Give him the swagger stick.
Oh, yeah.
Playing Pokemon all day. Swagger is a good move.
Oh, goodness. No, this is not all things Pokemon.
Sulu used swagger. It's super effective. It got him a helicopter.
It's always super effective. And of course, you gotta love Spock's like bathrobe thing that he's got going on.
Yeah, it's
with
good.
The padded
something.
Which I mean, like, apparently he has enough extra fabric in there to just tear some out and make a headband out of it. Which I guess is one.
And it seemed to tear really easy. So I was thinking, how thin and flimsy is that robe that you could just quickly just grab it and rip it apart?
It's very, very logical, well thought out costume. He's prepared for any situation.
He's even got a little, you know, swim outfit on underneath
it. Yeah, exactly.
That shows off his, you know, taut buttocks while he's in a tank.
Well, naturally.
So he could show off to the nun.
Well, I mean, who else really? Who else was he there for?
Gotta show Mother Superior what she's missing.
It also just occurs to me that he was able to tear that fabric in a straight line very easily. I mean, I don't know if any of you guys have ever tried to tear fabric with just your hands. It kind of goes all over the place.
But canvas tears very, very straight along the line, so maybe it's a canvas.
Is his robe made of canvas?
Part of it.
That sounds really uncomfortable.
Well, it's a Vulcan outfit. It's probably made for being in hot weather, so...
Is canvas good for hot weather? Is
it's light, yeah.
I don't know a whole lot about canvas.
Yeah,
I guess
it's cotton.
I guess I sort of assumed it was made of terry cloth, but you know, it looks
the
like
look.
Looks it would be the interior
look, the feel
with a terry cloth outerior to you know give.
All right, well, gonna...
She mentioned like logical clothing, and if going back to the beginning of the movie when they're still at Vulcan, and you know. Captain Kirk is addressing the crew in front of the HMS Bounty, and their Vulcans are all repairing the ship. Did you guys notice and remember the hats that all
yes.
the Vulcans were wearing? Is that a logical hat? Like,
well,
right? Is it shaped like a Smurf hat or something?
They look like candy drops to me. Like, I expected, like, you could just take them off and take a bite of them if you were hungry.
What are they, the Lollipop Guild?
I mean, they might be. Sometimes being on Vulcan makes me feel like I'm in Oz. It's like, you know, we are extremely logical. Now hold on while I bang this gong.
It's tradition.
It is, I suppose. You gotta have the three Vulcan women all, like, with their hands up like they're signaling a left turn on a bike.
Yep.
I mean, because that's logical is what that is.
You gotta do what you gotta do on Vulcan.
Apparently.
Make it through the day.
The tradition is silly and arbitrary, but God help you if you defy it.
Apparently.
God isn't very logical.
but the gongs and the hats are, though, just so we're keeping, well, we're keeping track of what's logical and what isn't.
Yeah.
All right. And so the one last thing is that this is kind of a minor thing, but this is the only movie of all of them where the phasers look really dumb. Like, did you notice that?
They look like little bee stingers,
kind of. Kind of. It's like this, it's kind of wide looking, and it's got this weird little prong on the end.
Like a little cattle prong.
They were trying something different, and it didn't work, so they changed it again.
Like,
I disagree. I'm sorry. You mentioned the phasers, and then also when Kirk is sitting at the pizza place with Jillian Taylor, she's like, you got a pocket pager, and he pulls this thing out and starts talking to it. To me, the phaser thing and the communicator, it looked like they were Klingon, more than Federation.
Oh,
the color scheme, the design of it, so maybe they didn't have their Starfleet stuff, and they had to, you know, go to an equipment locker in the Bird of Prey and pull out the Klingon.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. I was like, cool, Klingon stuff. But then Chekhov tries to stun that guy, and he's like, oh, it must be the radiation, and it don't work. And I'm like, wait a minute. All you got to do is get radiation, and now you foil the Klingon disruptors.
It's a trope in Star Trek that phasers will stop working because of whatever random field is around at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is probably the lowest of that, because, like, the radiation coming out of a nuclear reactor on an aircraft carrier is very minimal. Like, it has to be. Otherwise, everyone on the ship would die. So, you know, it's a very well-shielded reactor. So if that's the level of radiation it takes to make your phaser stop working, I'm just going to, like, equip all my ships with nuclear reactors, just, like, you know, in, like, a cargo bay somewhere, and give all of my crew members guns, and I think we'll be good to go. Also, it kind of raises the question of if Klingons would even have a Type 1, like, hand phaser thing.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very Klingon to me. You know, it just, it's small, it doesn't have that Klingon battle war feel.
Maybe it's a Klingon cattle prod.
That's possible. Or, you know, or a marital aid. We were talking about those earlier.
Well, it is Klingon, so...
All right, let's talk about the characters from the show. Uhura has nothing to do this movie. It's a tradition.
Yep.
Arguably, she had more to do last movie.
She kind of gets pushed down into being Chekhov's sidekick.
She is, a bit. I mean, like, she's there helping him be funny, I guess, and then she takes the thing...
She really plays a lot in the movies as just... She gets, like, a certain friendship per movie.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's the one, I think, in the next one, the God one, where she's Scotty's buddy.
Oh, God.
Right? That's
well, they can't
terrible.
Have a woman
but
be friends
time...
with too many people. It'd be
right,
boring.
But this time, her and Chekhov are kind of, you know... They're tight.
Yeah, this time, you know, she tags along with Chekhov, but whereas Chekhov gets his own, like, you know, his own scene, his own thing, she doesn't.
Nope.
Like, you know, and Sulu arguably doesn't either, because that scene had to be cut because of problems with the child actor.
But he's still got his swagger and everything, and he's always just, I'm the king of San Francisco,
And he got to have, like, a seduce a man for his helicopter, so,
as far,
you know.
That's the
implication
of what happened.
So, I mean, that's one of my sticking points watching all of these movies, is that Uhura is always underused, but moving on.
Well, she did do a really good job of finding that frequency, you know, just zeroing in on the whale, 401 megahertz or whatever. But it kind of was usurped or whatever, because she's playing with her controls and you hear the little beeps and, you know, sounds. And before Uhura can go, like, I have contact with the whales, Jillian goes, that's it. So it's like... You know, she tells us, and then, right, so when Uhura goes, confirmed, I have contact with the whales, like, yeah, she just said that.
It's also kind of funny when Uhura says, I'm receiving whale song, and it's like, how are you receiving it, exactly?
It's
like,
songs just for her.
You are in space. I mean, it's been posited that you could scan the ocean and look for vibrations in the water that would signify whale songs. But that's not what she said, and it's just so. Right. It's I'm
It'd
so.
Be like I. It would be better like I detect whale song, not like I'm receiving it like they're sending it to her.
That's what they're meaning by receiving. Like we are getting whale songs.
Yeah. I just think that the people who made this movie didn't stop to think too much about how sound travels in space. I think they were just
it
like.
It doesn't, does it?
Like they've seen the, no, not really. It was like they've seen other sci-fi movies where there's sound in space, and they're like, yeah, whatever. it'll be fine. Nobody'll notice.
The Enterprise always goes. Every time they warp, the Enterprise goes whoosh. So I thought there was sound out there.
There might just be air in space. Who knows? Maybe it's carried by the ether. And then we've got McCoy is the next one on my list. And he confuses me a little bit because his big thing is when they're in the hospital, right?
Yeah.
He's all like mad about like 20th century medicine. But in the past, he's been very old fashioned. Like, he's a simple country doctor, and he loves to give people, like, you know, put a splint on it and call me in 3 weeks kind of medicine. So I'm surprised that he was so, like...
He just really hates chemotherapy, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I understand him having better technology and wanting to help people. Like, that makes sense, but he was so angry about the medical technology.
It could just be, like, a misunderstanding of the past, right? Like, we might look back and fantasize about certain things, like splints.
He's able to romanticize the past,
yeah,
but when he's actually there, he's like,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
This isn't, like, cool. We have advanced. This is terrible. Ugh. Like, just, you know, the...
He's demon-sized.
He fancies himself a boy, but really...
Yeah.
And in this case, they're talking about, like, cutting his head open, so maybe he's fine with, like, you know... country medicine, old-timey stuff, but then once you're going to cut people open, and it's like, no, that's barbaric.
God's man!
Yeah, although there's also kind of a funny, like, division there between, so you've got in the, you know, the present, where you have surgeons who actually have to go in and do work, and be like, we have to, you know, be very highly skilled,
mm-hmm.
And know everything, and then you got McCoy, who just rolls up and puts a thing on Chekhov's head that really anybody could have done. I mean, you didn't need to be a doctor to do that. It's just like, hey, Kirk, put the thing on his head. And Kirk's like, okay. And then it goes. It's like plug and play medicine.
Yep.
Which makes me wonder if doctors in the future even have to go to school. Like, you know, I mean, in other Star Trek things, they kind of make it clear that
they have to go to school to get the bedside manner.
I guess.
Learned. It can't be taught.
They've all failed then.
I imagine there's a lot to just memorizing all the different species you have to interact with and the different ways to, you know. Mm-hmm. Anticipate and deal with them.
It just I thought it was a little bit sad that they established that even such a serious injury as what Chekhov had, because that was like brain damage stuff, which is still they've established in other Star Trek episodes is very hard to treat. All he had to do was put a thing on Chekhov's head, which
it
is
healed his brain.
You know, like I'm willing to buy the kidney regenerating pills, although you know again that causes some questions in other you know bits of Trek later down the road where they were
still
having
a great scene though.
Yeah, where they were having problems with the kidneys. What I'd like to think is that it actually just regenerated the kidney, and that the old woman was just a little confused. But you know who knows.
I got a second kidney. It would be weird.
Well, because, I mean, if you can imagine, I don't think having an organ spontaneously grow in your body would be very good for you. Just like, you know, it's not like there's a lot of empty space floating around in there.
Tumor that shapes and functions like a kidney.
I guess. It all happened very fast,
it's
too.
It's a very useful tumor.
Yeah.
But, I mean, McCoy's, like, whole deal, his whole interaction with Spock is still good. I mean, aside from maybe the next movie we have to review next week, I don't think there is one where their banter is bad. You know, like the whole, can't you tell me what it felt like? You have gone where no man has gone before. And Spock's like, you need to die before we can talk about this.
Yeah.
So overall, I thought that was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And it's
one quick thing I wanted to say about McCoy is at the end when they're all on the top of the bird of prey and they're jumping in the water and the whales are out there and they're like, where's the whales? How come they're not singing? They're all getting rained on, right? So they're in the water, it's raining, they're all wet. There's a couple shots of McCoy and his hair is all, you know, wetted down and everything, and the face he's making because they're all like, you know, in the water and in the rain and stuff. He kind of reminded me of Dr. Smeagol. I don't want to be too mean about it, but it's like, wow, DeForest, you're looking kind of
he's just very unhappy in the water.
Yeah, he's a cat man, actually.
I really liked that you could almost see McCoy's frustration at having Spock return to his old self.
Yeah.
Because, like, him and Spock had worked, and awkwardly and kind of like on the edge eventually developed a relationship that was friendly, but
now,
also
but now they're just back to square
and
one.
Now they're back to square one, and McCoy wants so desperately for it to be the friendly antagonistic. Or,
he's grown accustomed to his face.
Yeah, they are kind of back to square one. This is actually a much better, like, you know, conceit for Spock to have sort of forgotten his relationships with the rest of the crew than they had back in TMP. Because that was the same premise there, right? Was that for, like, Spock woke up one day and decided he was going to purge all emotion and he was all mean to everybody.
Right.
But in this one, he's, like, it's got, we've got a much better reason for why he doesn't just pick up his old relationships. Like, even with Kirk, he's like, I'm not going to call you Jim because that would be, wrong. It's going to be Admiral.
You're wearing, you know, you're on duty. Mm-hmm. You're wearing the jacket or whatnot.
Yeah. And so, like, that whole Spock's little journey, I thought, worked very, very nicely.
It was his journey home.
It really was. It really was his journey more than anybody else's. Although, again, because, you know... And,
also whales.
Yeah, and whales. I mean, I think Nimoy got to be a better director in this movie than he did in the last one.
Definitely.
I think when it comes down to it. And I don't know if that's just because he learned from the last one or because he was given more freedom. Because I've been led to understand that in the first movie that he directed in Star Trek III, he was basically being watched like a hawk because it was his first, you know, it was his first directing gig. But in this one, they gave him some more freedom, so that's a possibility. But I think overall, he got very good performances out of the other actors.
Definitely.
I mean, and like especially out of Kirk. Like I think you know, regardless of Shatner's shortcomings as an actor, I think this is one of the places he shines, which is in this sort of situational comedy. Where it's, you know,
he does comedy pretty well.
He does
really, really good timing.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, deep intellectual comedy for the most part. It's just like, it's, you know, this situation is kind of fun and funny at the same time. And I think Shatner does a good job with that.
Yeah.
You know, and the way
every little, like, all of his little gestures and emotes and everything, it was like right on good timing, right, you know, getting a point across without being over the top.
Yeah. And of course, like, in the beginning of the movie when they just pitch him the time travel story, which is kind of like a very silly story, the way that he's able to say, yeah, we're going to go back in time with complete confidence.
Yeah.
It's just like, you almost believe that that's an actual plan and it doesn't, not till a little later you stop and you're like, wait a minute, they can just do that? Just go back in time? Like, okay.
Well, the weird thing was is Spock gives him up the plan and McCoy is like, you got to be crazy. You know, if we don't get enough thing, we're going to die in the sun. But and then really quickly, and then they move on in dialogue. Shatner goes, we've done it before. And I was like, wait a minute. When did they go around the sun and go? I don't know. It was just weird. But
I think that was how they went.
It was in an episode. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually think that was how they went back in time in what was the backdoor pilot episode? Assignment Earth.
Yeah.
I think that's actually that was the
one. Oh, yeah.
Because they'd gone back in time once before that, but that was an accident involving like an ion storm or something.
Exactly. And then they did slingshot around the sun once before, and they're like, well, I guess we could do it. And Spock's like doing the calculations, estimates.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a problem with the story, which we'll get to in a few more minutes here. But like, and so I thought that Shatner did a very good job, even though Kirk as a character didn't have that much to do. He was sort of like directing things, but not a whole lot hinged on his decisions.
He was being captain, and that was about it.
Yeah, like he has dinner with Jillian, but she's not really that hard to convince, right? I mean, she's looking for someone to try to help her with the situation, and really, all he has to do is be there. But I thought,
facilitate her need. Well, you mentioned the difference in the movies, and there is a, like, in, like I said, there was a little bonus feature on this DVD from 99, and Nimoy kind of mentions the other movies and how this one is different. And he said they did all of TOS, and then there was like 11 years before they did the motion picture. And at that time, they're like, okay, we did a TV show. It was cool, but, you know, it was fun and humor at times and campy at times. And their attitude was like, now we're in movies. We must be serious and dramatic and everything must be important. And then we get the motion picture. And then he said, like, as they did each movie, they kind of were feeling it out, but then realized it doesn't have to be so heavy and serious and that way. But the Star Trek II was Khan, so like he said, that one felt to him very operatic, and it was like, you know, very big. You got Star Trek III where he says like there's fire and planets are blowing up, and it was really, you know, still kind of heavy and like big. But then he's like, this time we're going to have fun. Let's do a caper. Type thing, I think is how he said it.
Yeah.
And look, So they probably were more relaxed, and you know, that's probably why it felt better on different levels.
Right, and I think the comedy in this movie worked much better than the comedy in the last one did.
Yeah. Like, right. Well, part of it's that Spock and Kirk are back together. Yeah. You know, like, so much of the star of the TV show is the comedy that plays off, you know, them.
Yeah, and I mean, the last one, most of the comedy was based on everyone in Starfleet being a bunch of idiots, right?
Right.
And so they managed to avoid that this time, so the comedy didn't feel quite as absurd. Like, you know, you don't have Captain Riding Crop or, you know, or Lieutenant Adventure walking around. It's, you know, it's like the comedy arose more naturally from the moments.
Right, right.
I mean, you did have that one kind of goofy, like, naval interrogator guy with Chekhov, where he's just sort of like, you know, talking about the prisoner, like, within earshot of him. And it's like, you know, he can hear you. Like, he can hear you whispering. You're not whispering very quietly.
That's a weird interrogation tactic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Like, letting the prisoner know.
Stage that... whispering.
Maybe it was a failed intimidation. I don't know.
It's a callback, a throwback to Shakespeare. And like, yeah. Asides. It was an aside. There we go.
Good thing he can't hear us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think overall the comedy worked much better this time. And although one of the few, I don't know, maybe weaknesses of the movie, other than the overall plot, is that I don't think it made very good use of some of the side characters that I wanted to talk about just a little bit. Like, it was cool that we saw the first actual female captain in Star Trek.
That was cool. Woo! Short-lived.
She doesn't have a name.
But we establish her.
Also,
right.
Possibly the first not white captain? No, that was Captain Terrell. Sorry, that was like two movies ago. But still,
but
kind of...
Another interesting thing about her is that she was the captain of the Saratoga, and it was a Miranda, and I thought, is that like an unintentional foreshadowing to Sisko on the Saratoga?
Look, the Saratoga has, I think, been destroyed or blown up or otherwise ruined, I think, 3 or 4 times in Star Trek. You do not want to be on the Saratoga.
The Saratoga, a.k.a. the USS, totally jinxed.
Yeah, basically. And unfortunately, she doesn't have a name in the books. She's Captain Alexander. Still doesn't get a first name, but you know.
Maybe she's just got the one name thing like Cher.
Whatever, she was kind of cool. And I'm also pretty sure
it's
that
a masculine name.
I'm also pretty sure that her helmsman was the future president. I'm not positive about that, but I think...
President Red Foreman?
I think the president in Star Trek VI is one of her crew members. Like, he's got the same hair and everything.
That'd be fun to, like, check.
That was one of his like election credentials was like, I was on the Saratoga when the space probe came. I've seen things.
That's racist.
And they did give him some really dramatic close-ups where he was like in good lighting and is like, you know, looking at his face all.
Yeah.
It's like, that's presidential.
Basically. And I mean, like, we sort of shoo Savick out of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, she has her one scene and it's like, get out of here, Savick. We don't want
We're
you.
We're done with you.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is really too bad because... Like, the whole idea of the last movie was supposed to be that Savick and Spock have this, like, this teacher-student relationship, which they didn't really, but that was, like, the big idea of it, and in this movie, they're just gonna throw that out. They're not gonna stick to it, right?
They accept that sometimes they make mistakes. I'm like, you know, we tried that, it didn't work.
Yeah.
We can't just ignore it happened, so let's just, like, make an appearance, get rid of it. Move on with Star Trek.
Yeah, which is too...
Plus, do you really think Savick would have really added anything if she'd been around for the rest of the movie?
I'm not sure. It felt kind of strange that Savick wasn't going back with them to Earth. Like, it was very convenient. It was like in Time's Arrow and TNG when they beam Worf back to the ship, like, 2 minutes before they're all teleported back in time, where it would have been very inconvenient to have a Klingon. You know, it just struck
Time's
me...
Time's Arrow.
It struck me as being something that didn't really fit, right? It was very artificial. And then the only, like, it was cool to see Spock's mom again.
Yeah. She's
I think it's the same actress.
Yeah,
I'm not positive.
I think so.
I forgot to look it up, but I think it's the same actress. And of course, like, Sarek is cool. It's always nice to see Sarek around. Mm-hmm.
It's funny that we never, do we ever get to see Amanda and Sarek together in this movie?
No, we don't actually. They don't ever appear on screen together. Maybe they're having trouble.
Well, he's got to, you know... be stern at Starfleet, and she's got to be a mom to Spock, so...
Yeah.
They both have their priorities in this movie.
And then, like, the only major side character we really get is Gillian Taylor, who, I guess, kind of works as, like, a plot device. It's like, we needed someone to be friends with from the past so we could talk to Wales.
Mm-hmm.
I guess she works for that. But overall, like, I didn't feel that she was terribly important in the film. And, like, they beam her onto the ship, and then after that she didn't do anything.
Like, she gets a spiffy jumpsuit by the end.
That's true.
I think by this time in Star Trek, it's really hard to have a female character that's, like, has any relationship with her Kirk that feels important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, because she'd just be one of many.
Right, exactly. It's like, well, last time he had his wife and his son, and, you know, in the future he has this and this, and none of those people are important or less. So, here's a girl. She's for the movie.
Yeah. She's this movie's girl.
Although
she's
I do feel...
Like a Bond girl.
I do, in defense of Star Trek... In defense of Star Trek 2, I do think that that Marcus, Carol Marcus, had a very important role in the story.
Yeah.
And That's true.
Whereas if you took out... Like, basically, Gillian Taylor, if you take her out at the point where she jumps onto Kirk and, like, transports onto the ship, the movie basically doesn't change. Like, she could just not be there. And especially, I'm just confused why they didn't have her dive down to save the whales. Like, her and Kirk could do it together. It could be a tag team thing. Because Kirk's the hero of the movie, right? So obviously he has to be, you know, in that moment of tension. But, like, she is supposed to be, like, all defined by her love of whales. But she's like, ah, sure, let him drown, whatever. I'm getting out of here.
I guess she's not a strong swimmer. Who knows?
Yeah, which is weird for a marine biologist.
Right?
I was just so surprised. Like, I mean, not surprised, I knew what happened, but when I first saw it, I was like, I expected her to jump into the water with Kirk, especially with all that trouble he was having with that handle that he had to pull. You figure having another person would have helped.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Scotty's probably not a great swimmer, but, like...
Yeah.
He looks very buoyant, though.
Well, there's that.
That's good.
But,
Like you guys mentioned, she gets a cool, like, space jumpsuit, you know, cool suit later. But then she's also says that she's getting assigned to a science ship. And I kind of thought it was cool to take her forward because, like she said, if they get the whales into the future, like, she's a whale expert. So she would be able to help them, you know, repopulate the species and all that. But when they're, like, after the big scene of the, you know, you guys, you know, get your ship back and everybody's chat clapping and all that. Then they meet up and she's like, you're going to your ship. I'm going to mine. I kind of got the vibe where it was almost like for Kirk, the one that got away because he was like, you know, trying to wine her and dine her with the pizza place. And then after then he's like, you know, I don't even have your phone number. How am I going to get in contact with you? And she's like, yeah, don't worry about it.
I'll find you.
I'm going to go to my ship.
I'll call you.
Right.
Which of course,
and then he's sitting there. Right, we never see her again. But and at that point,
too good for him.
It's nice to have female characters who don't completely fall for Kirk.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it was nice that she wasn't just like there and that they didn't have a romance. Like, I appreciate that. I just wish they'd given her a little bit more to do.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, getting a poll here. Do you guys think that like whale slaughter video in the tour was something that she put in as like a protest stunt? Because that doesn't seem like something the museum would have approved of.
You don't know that.
You know, frighten off all the children.
Either way, it kind of turns my stomach to see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, you know, it's very ugly footage. It just strikes me as something I doubt the museum would have approved.
Yeah.
But I could
see... And probably not right out in the open, like where everybody is like walking in the main hall. You're just going to have that on display there. But I kind of thought, and it is all like for those who didn't see it, don't remember, whatever, it is actual real footage of whaling, and that's just really, you know, sad and disturbing and gross and all that. But I kind of saw it as serving two purposes in the film. Is for one, it gets across the message, like, you know, we shouldn't hunt species to extinction. It's very cruel, and it's like not, you know, but then at the other hand, that scene is set up right before they go, like, now let's go meet George and Gracie. Yeah. So it kind of sets it up like, you know, the danger for the whales. So that aside from the message of, you know, the species in general, like, don't over hunt a species, don't just slaughter them when you don't need to. It kind of made that set up where, like, once you just saw that, now you're going to see the whale characters, and it made it seem like it builds sympathy for those whales. Like, we don't want them to get caught by whalers. We don't want them to be, you know, hurt. Let's take him to the future.
And in the movie, that makes sense. We're just like in the museum at the time.
Yeah.
It seems like a bit much.
It also, it's just a little bit annoying because, like, the problem with hunting whales is that you're hunting them to extinction, right? That's bad. Nobody, you probably shouldn't do that because then you won't have any more whales. But, like,
we're all out of whales.
I mean, you could have made that same video with, like, pigs, for example, and it would have been really gross and no one would like it. But, I mean, we eat pig all the time, right? So, you know, it's not that...
They're not being hunted to extinction.
Yeah, like, I honestly don't think that hunting whales is inherently evil, right? I just think that if you... Like, you shouldn't overhunt anything. And whales are very easy to overhunt because they have a... They don't reproduce a whole lot.
They're very big.
Yeah, and there's that. And, you know,
they don't really have much self-defense, though.
They're so smart.
Yeah.
Well...
And gentle.
I mean, pigs are really smart, too, right?
But not gentle. Yeah,
true.
Well, that's true. They're not gentle. But I mean, you know, you can teach pigs to play video games. So I mean, if we graded animals that we shouldn't hunt based on their intelligence, say goodbye to your bacon, which I don't think any
Done.
Of us are quite willing to do. But
Done.
Well, maybe Chloe is.
well, another difference though is that like pigs, cows, chickens, all the you know the industrialized livestock that are used for food, they are like in. It's industrialized and there's, you know, it's maybe unhealthy, but it's like, I'm trying to think, whales don't have a factory. They got to go hunt them in their wild. They get pulled onto the boat and like killed and slaughtered and you know,
you
gutted and all that right there on the boat.
No.
And then it's like,
yeah, go ahead, David.
It's just different. It's not like a factory farm. It's just, you know, especially like nowadays, there's that show Whale Wars where we're talking about the Japanese whalers. And it's very, you know, down and dirty. It's very, you know, quick and cruel. It's not just like a animal that's been raised from birth in a factory. It's like a whale animal that's out in nature. It's doing, you know, not domesticated, but... It's just different, and at one point she says, like, we don't really need to hunt these whales for food anymore, even though they still do, but...
Yeah.
Just real quick, the reason why it turns into the whales, because a lot of people just think, oh, it's, you know, 80s, save the whales, but Nimoy said that he had been spending time with scientists and talking with them about all kinds of different subjects, and he heard... A lot of the common thing that he heard from the scientists were concerns about the future of the planet... And in terms of the ecology, and he got to a point where they are saying the ecosystem can handle a lot, but then there's times where it's really fragile. And he used the idea of a house of cards where you could, or I kind of wanted to call it Jenga, but he said a house of cards where you could pull one or two out, and well, because the losing species to extinction, like 1,000 species per year.
Yeah,
those are like pulling out cards of the ecosystem or the house of cards, and you could pull a few out and it's fine. It'll still hold up. But he called it the keystone card, where you pull that one keystone out, the whole thing crumbles. And it was the idea that certain species could be like a keystone, that if you lose that species, things go bad after that. And then they decided on the whales to represent that keystone species.
Sure.
And it just kind of goes along with what was, you know, at the time with Greenpeace and everything.
And Grace, what were you saying?
Another problem is with something like whale hunting, where it's all done free range, and it can't be done like factory farm style, like we were talking about. There's no way to regulate it and how to regulate how the whales are treated, which sounds silly, but it is a big thing. And actually, with a lot of the factory farms, they're really closely monitored, and it's really kept track that they're going. Whether they're going out of their way to, you know, take care of the animals up until their death and make sure it's quick and easy when they die. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no Temple Grandin for the whales.
Right, in sure. international waters.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't have a country be like, yeah, well, we can't do this and this and this.
There's no way to set precedent for something where they're just hunting them free range like that.
And whales are just so big, you can't just, like, shoot them in the head and kill them, right?
Right.
You have to, like, relentlessly go after them.
You have to stab the crap out of them.
Sure. Although I was actually going to bring that up in the opposite point, interestingly enough, Grace, was that it feels like a lot of factory farms are like inherently cruel and terrible because if you see the conditions that a lot of these animals are raised in, and I mean,
it's not the best, but the big name factory farm ones are very closely monitored by all the watchdog groups.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So
I took an animal ethics class.
Oh, yeah, good for you. Use it, you
me
know,
too, but it turned me the opposite side.
education.
It threw me into vegan.
Put to good use. So I don't know. I thought the video was a little bit underhanded, because it's like, yeah, we don't like seeing animals killed, but we also really like eating meat.
Yeah.
So it's like you could use that kind of video to dissuade people from eating just about anything.
Right.
I don't think it really communicated the actual problems involved in whale hunting, which is that because it's so unregulated and, you know, it's very easy to hunt whales to extinction, which is something you don't want to do. Right. I think most people can agree on that.
I guess you can only do so much in a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, I guess. Like I said, I'm pretty sure that was just a stunt protest that Gillian Taylor put in.
I think it.
She was upset that they were canceling her whale funding. Never would
have thought of it. She's a really rebel whale scientist.
Yeah.
She was just like, you take away my funding, museum, I'll show you.
Yeah.
I'll scar all your visitors. Oh.
The nuns and the children.
Especially the tiny babies. all right. So, Chloe, do you have time to stay for the plot discussion? It is 1:56.
Can stay for a little bit. That's
okay.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about
it's
the plot.
Only 1:56.
It is only 1:56.
Already.
It goes fast.
So it's really fast.
Time flies when you're talking Trek.
All right. So let's talk about the story a little bit. I'm going to skip dialogue because we already kind of talked about the dialogue and the comedy.
Good.
It's kind of what makes the movie work. The plot has two main issues from my mind. And the first one is the ease of time travel. Right, because, and that's not really so much an issue in this movie, but it's kind of impolite to everyone else who has to work in the Star Trek universe, because now they have to work with that over their heads. It's like,
Kirk can just travel in time when he wants to.
You know, it's kind of, it's the transwarp beaming of, you know, 1986 is what it is. It's the same issue of, you probably shouldn't introduce a piece of technology that's going to make it harder for other people to tell stories in this franchise.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, you're part of a franchise. You're not just telling your own movie. And we saw that. The transwarp beaming is part of the reason why the Star Trek Into Darkness plot has so many problems, because it's like, why didn't they just use the transwarp beaming to solve this? And it's the same problem here, where now every time something terrible happens in the Federation, you kind of have to wonder, why didn't they just go back in time and fix that? And what was that, Dave?
I think they addressed it briefly and like in quick dialogue and very short, so I don't think it had the same impact. But McCoy like protesting or saying, you know, this is crazy. That he was mentioning that, you know, it was not a sure thing. Like, they could have died doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if they played that up more, almost like the way they talked about David using the proto-matter that was unstable, that's why scientists don't do it. If they kind of played up more, that like even Spock saying we have a very low chance of this working, that could play into why other starships don't just go, let's go around the sun and go back in time, because... You know, it may create a temporal anomaly where they're, you know, at the point where they leave, it may kill them. And so I think if they made a bigger point of it, instead it's like, this is crazy, but let's do it anyway, and it works perfectly, you know. I don't know, that also, maybe that's also why they started the time cops, the temporal investigation later.
It seems inconsistent with the rest of Star Trek in, like, Gillian moving forward in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the, like, last time they went in the back where they went to the 1920s and there was a feminist, and they're like, no, she has to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't remember her name, but it was from the City on the Edge of Forever.
Yes. And they go back and, like, she has to die.
Edith Keeler.
Yeah, that's the one.
Edith Keeler must die.
And then they come here and they're like, oh, there's this big whale scientist. And, you know, you don't know what she would have been in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, we'll just bring her. She's cool.
It's
good guys.
Well, and look at Scotty and McCoy just giving that doc, that one plexiglass guy, like, hey, here's a formula. They're just like, you know, even McCoy says, you know, we could be messing up the timeline. And Scotty's like, how do we know that this guy did? Well, you could have looked it up. You know, you could have known who actually invented it. But there was a lot of, like, you know, messing with the timeline.
Maybe they really saw his big I quit smoking badge and thought he's earned it.
Yeah,
I guess he was wearing one of those.
Yeah.
I can kind of accept that the crew has just gotten so tired of regulations at this point, they just don't care anymore. They're just like,
we're done.
It's like, we're all going to be, you know, sentenced to prison anyway. Who cares at this point?
Go
whatever.
Big or go home.
Right.
I'm tired of having to tiptoe around the past.
It could be a project, right? They can look and see, like, did this doctor do this and this and this? Let's actually study effects of him doing this. That's
like,
cool.
You know, it's definitely, and judging from the fact that when they got back to the future, there wasn't like this like huge tech improvement because transparent aluminum was introduced early. I'd say Scotty was probably right.
Right.
Maybe he is the one who invented it in the Star Trek timeline, but just the fact that it's so easy to do seems problematic.
Yeah.
Well, and in this case, they might have felt like, you know, maybe this guy didn't invent it. Maybe Russia invented it or something. But it was kind of like it worth the risk, or it was like the Earth was going to be destroyed. Like the way, you know, Kirk is like, all life on Earth is going to be destroyed. Spock, haven't you got any feelings about that? So they probably like out, you know, in their mind was thinking, given this guy early tech, or who might not have been him, or all life on Earth dying in the future, I think it's like, yeah, let's give him the formula. You know, probably it was big things at stake, at risk, or at stake. So it's like, yeah, go ahead and mess with the timeline just a little.
Right, and I think the other problem that the story has, the other big one, is a lack of urgency in some sections. Like, there's a strong urgency to fix the dilithium crystals, because if that isn't fixed, then nothing is going to work. So right. That's, you know, that's urgent. And then there's the urgency to help Chekhov, because, you know, you got to help Chekhov because he's going to die, and we don't want that. No. But the whales thing is not really all that important. It's
right.
Like,
it's we could go somewhere else and save him. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little closer to the mic. But it's sort of like, if we don't get these whales, we could go get some more. I mean, there's other whales, right?
These are just the most convenient whales right now.
Also, yeah. The actual chances of them being released and then immediately running into a whale ship were not very high. So, you know,
But that's what happens.
It is what happened, but it's like, it felt like they knew that, right?
Yeah.
Like, they knew that these were the only whales they could ever get, even though that wasn't actually true. And that was what they were basing all their actions around. When, like, you know, when Spock...
Well, but this one was already conveniently, you know, married, and they're already pregnant. So it's like, let's just get those. It makes our job a lot easier.
They're a nice couple.
Sure.
like them.
Which is fine, except that they are, like, when Spock talks to Kirk and is like, we have to go help Chekhov, and Kirk is like, is that the logical thing to do, Spock? And Spock says no. I'm like, wait, of course it's the logical thing. How is it not logical to go and rescue your fallen crewmate? And the only reason I could think of is that it's costing them time that they have to be using somewhere else to get the whales, but there's not really any real rush on that. Like, you know, again, if they don't get these whales, they can get more whales later.
Or maybe it turns out that before he had all that character growth, Spock just really didn't like Chekhov.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, if anything...
The annoying Russian is gone. Good.
If anything, it's more logical to go get Chekhov because, I mean, what if Chekhov did survive, then
yeah.
a bunch of people...
Right, and then Chekhov's in the 1970s
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah, 80s, and then a bunch of people from 80s, the 80s yeah. are interrogating Chekhov, and eventually he might crack and tell them all about the future. That's no good.
He'd crack eventually.
He probably would.
Well, and Chekhov is really not good about protecting secrets because he just threw that phaser right back to the interrogator.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it must be the radiation. Right when he runs, he throws it back to him. So now they have that tech. But I saw that scene as a callback because, you know, the ship was repaired. They had the whales. And now, you know, we got a man. He's probably going to die, but, you know, never leave him. But so maybe it was logical to, like, just get back home, save the planet, you know, all that. But it was a callback to because in the earlier scene with Amanda, she's saying, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. But in this case, it was reversed because she's like, all your friends sacrifice so much for you, for one. And like, that's the only reason why you're there. And he's like, well, humans make illogical decisions. But then we go to that scene where it's like, it is, again, it's like the many going after the one, you know, the needs of that one, Chekhov. You know what I mean? It was just like a counterpoint to that scene with Amanda, and it was kind of showing that Spock may not be back to his full self, but he's starting to realize he should be, or, you know, what would have been the more logical, I mean, the more human, emotional, like, thing to do, the more human thing.
And I understand that's what they were trying to do. It just didn't click because, again, there was no sense of urgency.
It's a situational difference.
Yeah. There was no sense of urgency with the whale plot. Like, if there had been, then Spock saying we have to help Chekhov would have had more impact, I think. Mm. And I think really that's kind of what the biggest problem with this movie boils down to is that, because it's supposed to have an environmentalist message, right, mm-hmm. of don't hunt the whales to extinction. That's probably it, which is a message I think we can all agree with, but... Mm-hmm. It's sabotaged somewhat by the kind of slipshod nature of the story, where it's like, there's this probe, and we don't really know what it's doing, and we're saying some really nonsensical things about it, like how it's not hostile, And it's like, how do you know it's not hostile? Where did you make that judgment, right, Spock? I mean, it is not destroying,
is
but...
Is he going to mind meld with the probe?
It is, like, wrecking all these ships it comes across and, like, basically dooming all life on Earth.
Right.
And it's like, it's not hostile? I mean, it seems hostile.
Uh-huh. It doesn't feel friendly.
And, of course, the whole idea that whales could possibly be communicating with a probe from, like, you know, whoever knows how far away, right? Like, that whole idea is just very absurd, and so some of it, because it's like...
It's good, Orin, it's good. I mean, it
all works.
Trust me.
And so you'll notice that what we remember about this movie isn't really the message. What we remember is the comedy, right?
Yeah.
And the message kind of gets lost, because if we think about the message, then we start to think about the plot, and we're like, wait a minute, that didn't make any sense. Like, the message...
Well, but that's almost a better way to go about it, because if they reversed it and the comedy was kind of taking a backseat and they were really hitting you over the head with, and like in that documentary part with Nimoy, it's Save the Whales, and she even has a bumper sticker, I love whales.
Yeah.
But the whales were supposed to represent the ecology, like,
right.
And there are different comments where Spock is like, I know we're in the right place because of all the pollution in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like, you know, the message of the, say, you know, whaling, but then above that, you know, how you treat animals, but then the ecosystem. But if they hit you over the head with that, I think more people would be like turned off by it.
Sure.
It's like,
yeah,
don't be so preachy, and, you know, we get the point. You don't have to overdo it. So there's message there, but it is, Nimoy said, by this time, they went through, you know, Khan and the third one. So now it's time to have fun. So they put comedy and humor and, you know, that front and center.
Chloe, what were you saying?
I love that in a movie or a story, too, where, you know, you watch it and you get the comedy and stuff. And then, like, 4 years later, like, something comes about whales. And you're like, yeah, we'll save the whales. It's like in Star Trek, and it almost feels like it's this big epiphany, and you're like,
yeah,
and you know, then
this
you want to write
a thing,
right? You want to write a thesis about it, so it's like, no, it's just that's what the intention
are you
was,
are you
guys.
Speaking from experience here?
No.
No.
What? No.
I mean, just to be clear, I'm not saying that they should have hit you over the head with the plot, with the message. What I'm saying is that because the message is tied in with this kind of absurd plot, I think it does get lost a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as effective a message, because it's like, you know, it's like save the whales, but the only reason that they save the whales is because this probe is threatening to blow them all up. It's not because they think the whales are valuable on their own, because if they could have gone back and gotten them by now if they really thought that.
Yeah.
So
they hadn't had time to think about it, really.
Yeah, it never came up.
Yeah, that's
they could
really
have, like, all turned to the camera at the end and go, well, I guess we really learned something about whales today.
Like, I enjoy subtlety in a message, right? I think it's important. Yeah. I rail against episodes of later Star Trek where they just say, this is the message.
Yeah.
Calm yourself down. Although not always. Like, I'm okay with some of the messages being kind of blatant. But for the most part, I think that you do want some subtlety. I just wish that they had come up with a story that fit together a little bit better.
Yeah,
like,
that's fair.
And that's, it's not really a huge problem for this movie. Clearly, this movie is good despite those things.
Yeah,
it is.
It's a fun movie.
It is very fun, and it's funny, which is something that, like, Star Trek doesn't have a great track record with comedy. but it, you know, it works here.
It's hit or miss, but they hit.
Yeah, so. This definitely worked very well.
Yeah.
I think that's what it comes down to for me, is that it was my final thoughts on the movie is that it's really good. I wish that it had been a little bit better in terms of its overall story, that didn't make me kind of stop and every couple minutes in the movie and be like, hey, wait a minute, what are you talking about? But overall, it works very well. Grace, what do you think?
Honestly, the one thing I took away from my most recent viewing of the movie is, George and Gracie! George Burns and Gracie Allen. Only just got that.
Whoosh.
And I felt like such an idiot for not getting it. Because there's so many times that Leonard Nimoy has been like, yeah, so much of Spock is based on the George Burns, Gracie Allen dynamic of, I cannot believe your shenanigans. This is ridiculous attitude. So it makes perfect sense. And after years of just being like, oh, well, I guess they both start with the letter G. You'd think I would have figured that out by now.
Mind blown.
This is why I drink.
Do you think they should have worked in the dialogue, say goodnight, Gracie? I don't know how they would have gotten that into
something
the script.
Something like that.
But It would have been cool.
It a little one more thing... obvious for stupid people like me. But then you wouldn't have had the great epiphany last time.
I know!
I want to touch real quickly, like probably just one or two comments, but this was the first time, we're in halfway point of the TOS movies, right? Because we got three and then we got six movies and then the seventh movie that has Kirk and some of them is Generation. So we're kind of halfway through the TOS movies, but this was the first time we got Star Trek product placement.
Yeah.
Did you remember the big giant yellow pages wall and different stuff like that? But one of them that was really subtle, like you would definitely miss it because they hit you over the head with that one, like, oh, we can't find it. Oh, and then they turn around and it's like, find it in the yellow. But a real subtle one that was like just in the background and real small was on the bus, the fun bus scene. There's a guy that quickly holds up, and even like it's even quickly, it's not just lingering. He holds up an Omni magazine. And I was like, oh my God, I loved Omni magazine. It was so cool. And I was sad when they canceled it. So that was just like a fun memory of seeing like, oh, look, there's Omni. And we used to, it was just cool. But it also showed that it, like, you know, addressing science, you know, that type of thing, that even then there's, you know, trying to give nods to things that are scientific.
I'll see your subtle product placement and raise you an offhand reference. At one point, when they're in the Italian restaurant, apparently Michelob is a brand of beer.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Like, I don't drink...
Michelob Ultra.
Because I don't drink beer. I thought it was a pizza topping. So, like, that's, like, very, you know, like an offhand product placement. But, you know, I think the product placement in this movie is fairly innocuous, right? Like, it makes sense because they're back in the 80s. Like, these products were around.
It's subtle as far as product placement goes. You know, it's, like, not Michael Baying it into our faces.
It's not... I'm not going to name any names here, but it's not Uhura walking into a 23rd century bar and ordering Bud Lights. All right.
Yeah.
Chloe, I think you might have to get going.
I just got cold.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right, that's fine. What's your final thoughts on the movie?
I really liked it. It's one of my favorite Star Trek movies. I mean, I always look back on it with just such warm feelings and fond memories. It has holes and everything, but it keeps the character dynamic so well.
Yeah.
The relations between them, which I lost so much in a lot of the films.
Yeah. We love it, holes and all.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a
little, Swiss cheese.
Like a good little pasta strainer.
We love it because of the holes, not
That's
in spite of them.
All right. Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up.
Yeah.
We're getting better at this one-hour format thing.
Somewhat.
Sorry.
So just another thing I wanted to say just real quick is that this movie represents basically to me the ending, the wrapping up of the through line of the Genesis and the Spock thing. I mean, because after this, we get Star Trek V, which goes in a whole other different direction. So you have, you know, Star Trek Wrath of Khan. It starts the Genesis story. Three continues that story with, you know, fun Klingon action. And then this one at the beginning of the movie, they're actually kind of having hearings and court procedures or, you know, open forum at Starfleet about Kirk stealing the Bird of Prey. They show the Genesis video in the background. And so it's kind of a nice wrap up to that three movie, like, series arc, whatever you want to call it. So that was just very cool that, you know, there was and with Savick saying, you know, David died saving us all. You should have known that. It was just nice to, like, this is the end. It ends in a upbeat, you know, and then the next movie, it's on to different things.
Greener pastures.
Well,
such as they are.
I don't know if I'd call that. You can listen to us next week for our thoughts on Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. But for now, stay tuned for Data Logan's thoughts on Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. I think this will be All Things Trek signing off. David, if you go ahead and take it away.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's data log.
One is my name. The other is not.
27 October 2013. Hello, computer. Oh, good. The microphone works on this one. I don't have to use the keyboard. How quaint. Just wanted to share with you a couple thoughts about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. At this time. I think I continue to like the Savick character more than you guys do. And again, in this movie, her story gets devalued a little bit, with the original story and script saying that Savick was pregnant at this time with Spock's kid, and that's why she wasn't going back to Earth with him. It was always a little odd to me that Spock says that he needs a common frame of reference in order to talk about life and death with McCoy. I.e. McCoy needed to die before he could talk about life and death with Spock. Bones has died. He was declared dead by Tricorder in the original series episode Shore Leave, and maybe in the Empath as well, or at least he was very close to death. But obviously McCoy didn't die in the same way that Spock did, and he wasn't resurrected in the same way. But then again, McCoy was part of that process too, so it seems like, obviously, McCoy and Spock should have been able to talk about it. It was just Spock, once again, being his usual aloof self. Yes? No? Yes? Yes. I love this movie, and so do you. This movie is just so fun compared to most of the other Star Trek movies. I mean, they have their moments, of course, usually relating to adventure and defeating the bad guy. But this one's just a fun romp. The fish-out-of-water stories are always fun. And it's easier to forgive the movie all the little inconsistencies that it has in plot, nuclear technology, political and legal simplicity, you know, breaking the temporal prime directive, you know, all those other things, because the story is just so fun and character-driven versus the more plot-driven movies. The fact that Spock can mind meld with a whale, does that mean whales are sentient in some respect? Or is Spock able to mind meld with all animals if he wanted to? That's always been a big question in philosophy and morality. How do you differentiate between a sentient person and a pretty intelligent creature like a dolphin or a dog? I guess if we had telepathy, it'd be a lot easier. I would just expect that telepathy wouldn't work the same between sentient beings as it would between other less sentient creatures. Chekhov's fish-out-of-water moments in the movie are him on the street corner asking for where the nuclear vessels are, and then he gets captured and interrogated by some kind of U.S. government officials who clearly identify him as a Rusky. It's a little weird for me looking back watching this movie. I mean, I was only 9 when the movie came out in theaters. I do remember watching it in person. It was the first movie that I really clearly remember watching in the theaters. But I don't think I understood the political dynamics of the situation at the time, because I was so young. And now when I watch back and I look at the movie, I really have to remind myself that, oh yeah, this is during the Cold War, and he's Russian, and that probably would increase the suspicion that people had towards him, and especially the U.S. government officials. I think I remember reading somewhere, somebody theorized that Kirk and company, when they went back in time during this particular incident, picked up colorful metaphors and then brought them back to the future and reintroduced them into society. Because you'll notice that colorful metaphors become a little more common in the 5th and 6th movie. And then, of course, in the 24th century. The movie has some really well-done special effects, especially with the whales. I had heard that some environmentalists had actually protested the movie, believing that the filmmakers had gotten really too close to the humpback whales and they should have backed off. And then they came to find out it was just animatronics, not real-life humpback whales on the screen. That's right, Greenpeace. There be whale models here. I know the original casting idea for the movie was to have Eddie Murphy star as the character that would eventually become Gillian Taylor. He was, of course, a hot product at the time, and they wanted to increase the Star Trek ratings. Well, I could definitely see him as that role in the movie, with some slight changes, you know, like a little less flirting between Kirk and Taylor. All right, thanks for listening to my thoughts about Star Trek IV. Anyone remember where we parked? Dead out.